This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. This is Raise Your Game. I'm Maya Tan. Today, I've got Roshan Thiran, CEO of Leaderonomics, here with me. Welcome back.
Yep, we'll be back.
Today, we're talking about developing best-in-the-world leaders and talent. Yep. So, best-in-the-world, you know, what's the concept all about, and doesn't everyone already strive for it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is. But you see, the problem is I think many people want to achieve. I give you a couple of examples. I met a couple of guys who were best in the world over the last couple of years, I guess. One was a guy called Pierluigi Collina, who was at that time declared the best. He's this bald-headed famous FIFA referee, right? Okay. He was declared the best referee in the world. And I was interviewing him for our show, and you know, I was talking to him, and in fact, I think he's coming back to Malaysia in a couple of weeks' time. And we were talking about what makes you best in the world. And he said, I need to be prepared for games. I got to make great decisions under pressure. And he said, sometimes I make mistakes. And he talked about it's a very important Champions League game that he was refereeing against Villarreal and Everton, and he somehow made a big mistake. But how he learns from it and moves on from it. And he went on to talk a lot about, you know, this, that. And then, you know, I met Lee Chong Wei. Again, Chong Wei, right after he lost to Lin Dan in the final of the Olympics, and that was 2012. And he said, you know, it's about hard work, it's about sacrifice, it's about practice. And then Nicole David said something, you know, not really similar, but different things. So everybody seems to have a sense of, you know, we got to be the best in the world, you have to do all these things. But there didn't seem to be a certain similarity, you know, or they didn't seem to say it. But as you start to study their lives, you start to see actually there is some sort of similarities. There's a sort of environmental cues. There's certain factors that enable people to be best in the world, factors that depend on them and also potentially don't depend on them. And the combination of this is what makes them world-class or best in the world. And that's what we're going to talk about, I think, today. It's really how do we understand what these factors are and what is it? And it's really hard work. A lot of people work hard, but they don't become best in the world. So there are a lot of people sacrifice, but they don't become best in the world. What is it that makes people become really best in the world? So that's really what we're going to talk about.
All right. So just out of interest, you know, what were the common factors or the environmental cues that you mentioned that you noticed from these three personalities?
Okay, so we're going to talk about that. So there are a couple of things that really drive, hone these things. And I learned this. Let me talk a little bit about the experience of when I started to learn about this. One of my personal experience in being best in the world was when I was actually part of a leadership team of a Malaysian company that was trying to drive a company that's really, you know, really, really badly run. I mean, one of the worst productivity was one of, like, worst in the world at that point in time. A normal company would do a service, you know, it's a servicing company. They take about 40 days or so to service a product. But this company took on average about 450 days. So it's about 10 times worse than the best in the world.
Wow. So
you know, as I went into this company, I was struggling significantly because it seemed like an impossible assignment. The employees there were I would say not interested in changing, and every time I want to do something, hey, you can't, because that's not the way it is, and there's a lot of compliance, a lot of structural things, and after 2 years of working with them and really working on these cues that I will be talking about in a little bit, we started to see them move not just to 40 days. I mean, the best in the world used to turn around their service in 40 days. They used to do it in 35 days, becoming the best in the world. But we didn't change the people. I mean, many people said, you know, it's about the people, right? Let's change the people. Let's eliminate. Let's bring in better people. But we kept the same employee base. In fact, the employee base shrunk a little bit. And more interestingly, they did 10 times the business. So it was a small $30 million business. It grew to about $350 million. So from a small 30, you know, from it grew 10 times, it became 10 times more productive, and they had less people than they had previously. And every aspect of the business, from profitability to the management of inventory, everything sort of became very, very good. And as I started to, you know, as we started to look at the cues, right, we started to realize that to make people best in the world, there are a number of key issues. It's not about the people. People are generally constrained by some different things in organizations, and that is essentially these factors that we'll be talking about in a little bit. So if you want me to run it, so the factors are really, there are two big factors essentially. The first piece is what we call organizational infrastructure, and the second big piece is called individual motivation. Now this makes world class. So let me talk a little bit about organizational infrastructure. Organizational infrastructure is made out of four pieces that constrain folks. So these four things that constrain folks are first and primarily, it's things like the business model. Now, if like, imagine, you know, a couple of years ago, Nokia was being challenged in the smartphone industry by Apple and Samsung and the other guys, right? Now, Nokia took a long time to revert and saying, you know, we too have to play in the game. And what happened is they had a business model that at that time didn't work for the kind of state of the world at that point in time. Mm-hmm. Now, even though they may have very engaged employees, very good employees, high talent, you know, they have all these fundamental factors in there. If your business model is wrong, you know, you just will not be able to fix your organization. So it starts first and foremost with the business model. Now, the second piece is what we call we call leadership. Now, leadership is another constraint. So even if you and leadership is not just the senior leaders, right? Leadership at all levels, and I'll walk you through a little bit. But even if you have leadership at a very lower level, that's not you constrain employees from being high performers or being world class. The third piece is what we call processes and structures, and I'll walk you through a little bit. But this is, if you have the wrong process and the wrong structure, no matter how hard you push, even if you have good leaders, you will not be able to enable yourself to have this organizational infrastructure. And the last piece is leadership. The last piece is culture. Now, these four elements make what I call organizational infrastructure. I'll give you a little bit of an example of what organizational infrastructure is. When I was young, I went to the US to study, and I was a little bit frustrated because I see these American guys, they seem to be very... very good at talking in class, you know. So every time I go to university, right, they'd just be able to answer questions, talk, and they can just talk about anything. And I was the guy, like, you know, every time I have to think, and okay, what am I going to do? And the teacher always scolded me, like, hey, you're good in the written piece, but very bad in class participation, so I'm going to mark you down. So, you know, I remember one class, sociology, I think they were talking about a death penalty, and I said, hey, in Malaysia, we practice death penalty, right? So I should be able to talk about this. But somehow these guys were able to talk so well, and I said, what's wrong? How is it that these guys are, you know, can contextualize everything and seem so smart, you know? And so I started talking to my friends. I said, what do you all do? I mean, how do you get so much, so knowledgeable about all these things and be able to talk so comfortably? And I started to find something very interesting. In the US, around 8 years old, many of these kids, first, they have this ritual called set up a lemonade stall. So they have a rite of passage that every kid sets up a lemonade stall. So usually at 8 years old, they set up a lemonade stall in front of their parents' house. And then after about a year, they decide, oh, I'm okay, I can sell people, but there's just not enough demand, so I'm going to move the lemonade stall to a more busier place, like in front of a mall or in a football field or something like that. And so they do that. And when they go there, and I always say, oh, that was the worst thing I ever did. I say, why was it worse? Yeah, because when I set it up there, although I got more customers, a lot of guys came to me, I don't want to buy your lemonade, it tastes bad, or they felt rejected, they felt, you know. So at 9 years old, right, they're learning entrepreneurship skills. They learn that location is important, but more importantly, they get rejected. You know? They're trying to sell and people reject them, right? So by 9, 10 years old, they actually get all these experiences. And then at 15, they're working in Burger King to earn enough money so that they can buy a car at 16. And by the age they're 17, 18, when they go to university, they achieve all these experiences. And then I look at myself, hey, I've never been rejected, you know, because I never done
sales
before.
We're very protected here in Malaysia.
I've not set up my own business, you know, I've not done all these things. And then I say, infrastructure, right? The country gives an infrastructure that enables entrepreneurship, enables a business to some extent, right? Enables people to develop a sense of confidence that is slightly different from other countries. The same is organizationally. If you want to develop best in the world leaders, the infrastructure you develop needs to be of a state. And the infrastructure is made out of those four things that I talked about, the business model, the culture, the process, and leadership. And the other piece is the individual, and we can talk about the individual later.
All right. Well, so I guess, you know, part of it involves a process. You've got to have organizational infrastructure and individual motivations. And there were four pieces that you mentioned. Let's start with leadership. You know, what does that mean?
Yeah. So leadership commitment is really about getting the leaders really committed to building world-class leaders. So it starts, it's not just, you know, so a lot of CEOs will say, people are the most important for us and so on and so forth, right? But it means that they actually have to build, they actually have to be committed to doing things that enable you to build a pipeline of talent. So if it's talent that you're trying to look at, so are you committed to really giving them experiences? Because people need to grow by experiences, which means that, hey, if I got a person who's really good at a certain role, why am I willing to take that person out of role and put them in another role, which they might not be so good at initially, but to give them the exposure, even though that may be not so good for your business at that point in time. But those are the things that's one piece the second piece of what leadership is you need to build leadership at every part of your organization. So it's not just at the senior leader level that I'm saying, but see, for me, if you are reporting to a manager, say you report to a manager, right, Maya? So that manager is your world. That manager is BFM to you. So how that manager acts to you, treats you, grows you, cares for you, and focuses you is what you think of your organization. It's not what Malik and at that level do, right? I mean, to some extent it is, but in most cases, your manager becomes your worldview of what the organization is. So you need to have managers at all levels that are committed to building the leadership demand process, that are committed to building employees, that are committed to putting in, later on we'll talk about the processes and the systems, but that's what leadership commitment is. Leadership that is good leadership, great managers at all level that enable talent to grow, but also to ensure that leadership walks the talk and talks the walk, I guess.
It's all part of looking at every individual's career path as well and developing them all the way through, right?
Absolutely, yep.
Right, I'm speaking to Roshan Thiran, CEO of Leaderonomics. When we continue the conversation, we're going to be talking about systems and structures on Raise Your Game, BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to Raise Your Game. I'm Maya Tan. Today, we've got Roshan Thiran, CEO of Leaderonomics, here with us. And we're talking about developing best-in-the-world leaders and talent. So we've talked about the need of having an organizational infrastructure, and part of it involves, well, there are four elements that are part of it, business model / strategy, culture, processes or systems and structures, and leadership. So we've covered leadership. Let's look at systems and structures.
Yep. So systems and structures. Structures are simple. It's basically when you want to build leadership, you need to have clear systems and structures. So I give you an example. So one of the things we have as a system and structure in many companies is to do performance evaluation. So once a year, or sometimes you're lucky, twice a year, you get some feedback from your boss in terms of your performance. But just think about it. If Usain Bolt, right, the best athlete in the world, right, or best 100 meter sprinter in the world, had a boss, had a coach who told him, look, once in 6 months, I'll give you feedback, right? So we'll meet once in 6 months. In the meantime, you know, just go ahead and train and do your stuff. And then once 6 months, we'll meet. I'll give you a midterm feedback. And then at year end, we will assess you again and I give you another feedback. You think that the likelihood of him being world's best sprinter will be there. But, you know, instead, his coach on a daily basis is observing him, is giving him feedback. So I'm just talking about one process. So to become a finely tuned employee, or high performance employee, the manager, again, you know, talked about the commitment of the manager first, right? But there must be systems and structures to say that it's not just having a conversation once every couple of months with your employee. It's about daily feedback. It's about, and the feedback should be very clear in terms of examples, should be, you know, in terms of here's how you improve. How do you help people hit a certain expectation? Feedback, you know, there also needs to be structures in terms of how do you grow a person? How do you give them experiences? So what kind of structures do you have? I'll give you an example. When I was in General Electric a number of years ago, I'm not sure whether they practice it today, but many years ago, you know, after about 18 to 24 months, most of us were encouraged to rotate to a new role. Now, even though, you know, your bosses will say, no, stay, we want you there, you know, you're doing a great job. But we had the liberty of looking out and then the structure was such that you were allowed to go look for other roles to ensure that you yourself had career was your own kind of prior. I mean, you had to take ownership of your own career. So you had to figure out
fulfillment as well, right?
Yeah, but it's the structure, right? It's not about the boss saying go. Because you again, when you don't have systems and structures, you have some good bosses, some not. But when your structures, right, it's part and it's a process, right? There's a process for talent management. I spent a number of years ago visiting Everton Football Club, and I did a little session with them, and I got to meet Ray Hall, who's the coach of Wayne Rooney, and he was telling me that at Everton they have a structure in terms of how they build world-class talent. So every year a 16-year-old boy will become a world-class football player to some extent. So they have a structure, what they do at 10 years old, what they do at 12 years old, what they do at 15, and everything is part of a process. So it's not accidental that they have a Wayne Rooney or they have NHB, all the different players that they've sort of groomed over the last couple of years, and it's part and parcel of the development process. And if you look at companies like GE, the systems and structures, or Shell or Unilever or some of the top companies, they have a process or structure for talent management. And so leadership commitment is important, but more importantly is system structures. And I'll give you an example. Sometimes your CEO may shout and say, go get things done. But that may not necessarily mean he that person can fight against structure. And I'll give you an example. When I was at NBC, it's a TV company a number of years ago, owned by GE at that point in time. Jack Welch was the CEO, and he was insisting that everybody implement Six Sigma. So I remember I was at NBC, and we had a big party, and we, we had this QNBC and Six Sigma. We got T-shirts and hats and all this great stuff. And after about, after 2 hours, a couple of days later, we all forgot what Six Sigma was and never got implemented, right? So Jack went around and was a bit angry that why isn't, and Jack's a tough CEO, right? Mm-hmm. Why isn't people listening? So even though leadership is shouting, even though leadership is committed to that change, nothing changed. And then he made an interesting system and structure change. He made a rule that nobody in GE could be promoted unless they were green belt certified, right? So suddenly, I had motivated to not just sign up for green belt, sign up for black belt. And a lot of my colleagues all, rushed to sign up for Six Sigma training. What happened? You got CEO commitment, but you also need to have systems and structures, and then you will talk a little bit about the other two, but also you need the culture piece and business model. I guess that one is a given,
But that's kind of still ruling by fear, right? It's like you won't get promoted.
But it's a system. You can say it's that, but it's a structural thing, right? Mm. So as a HR person, you know that if a person is not certified, they cannot be promoted, right? I mean, that's just the way the policy of that organization works. So, I mean, it's the same with, let's say I'm a CEO and I have a lot of sales, but I just have bad collections. My sales guys don't collect, right? And if I look, my policy is that I pay my commissions to my sales guy based on sales. Now, let's say I change my policy and I say, look, I'm going to change my policy to, I'm going to pay you commission based on collections collected, meaning after the sale is done, the money comes in and I'll pay you the commission. Guess what's going to happen? It's going to help cause a change in behavior, right? Because that's what systems and structure is. Because now, suddenly these guys are motivated because that's the structure, right? So we sometimes, and this is the infrastructural piece, right? I give you an example in the US, right? The process is such that, it's structural, such that, kids do the lemonade stall and people will buy from them. And I mean, it's part and parcel of the infrastructure. And organizations sometimes, I think we focus on the process and we do focus on leadership. But I think the third element is the one that sometimes we get stuck on, which is the third piece, which is the culture piece.
Does culture play a part? I mean, culture involves a sort of mindset and attitude as well. So does that play a part?
And I define culture slightly differently. So culture to me is, culture is beliefs, right? I mean, it's rituals and beliefs, right? It's really the rituals that we do on a day-to-day basis that defines what culture is. And here's what culture, most companies do not purposely design culture, so it becomes accidental, meaning the loudest guy speaks. And who's the loudest? Generally, it's the most disengaged. Generally, it's the person who, the gang leaders are generally the folks who will take people out and say, let's go talk, and then we talk bad about the organization and so on. Those are generally the most disengaged folks. And Gallup says, about 20% or so, or 20+% of your engaged are actively disengaged, which means they're actively seeking more people to join them in the disengaged world. Now, that happens when you don't design your culture. So culture essentially to us is like this. I give you an example. Let's say Malaysia, we have a culture of not keeping our toilets very clean, to some extent. So we've tried. I mean, I remember in 2005, there was campaigns, keep toilet clean, toilet campaigns. We have lots of that, right? But for whatever reason, it never really works. And even though leaders can shout, you got the leadership there, and we even put structures in place, we do a lot of stuff, but for whatever reason, we don't. But that's why you ask the question, maybe Malaysians cannot keep toilets clean. We just don't have the capability. But it's very strange. If you study a Malaysian that goes to Singapore or Australia, we actually can keep toilets clean. So it's not a capability issue, right? So we obviously have the capability to keep toilets clean. So it's something else. So then you study, you go a little bit deeper and say, why is it that we don't keep toilets clean? It's because when we go into a toilet and we look at it and say, goodness, our experience tells us that the other guy will not keep the toilet clean. So then we formulate, we formulate a belief. A belief is no point keeping toilets clean in Malaysia because somebody else will keep it dirty anyway. Mm-hmm. So then we say, no, let's not bother, right? So then our belief translates to action and our action translates to result, right? So culture is essentially rituals or experiences that translates to belief. So for you to change culture, you actually have to change experiences. So you have to change the ritual. When you change the ritual, we start to change the belief. When we start to change the belief, we start to change the action, and the action then change the result. And a great example was, I moved to New York in 92, late 92, early 93, when Rudy Giuliani just became mayor of New York. And in 92, New York was the world's most dangerous city. It was considered the highest murder per capita in the world, right, in New York. So there was most murders per capita in the world in New York City. Within 3 years, or 3 or 4 years, you know, New York became one of the safest cities in the world. And if you see what Mayor Giuliani did, was he just focused on culture. He didn't, you know, here he had the leadership, right? I mean, he had the leadership, you know, he changed some processes, but essentially it was culture. And here's what he did. He says, you know, let's not bother about catching murderers. Right. So, I mean, essentially, they use this theory called the broken window theory, right? So, let's not catch murderers. Let's change the perception of New York. So, we started the I Love New York campaign. They painted all the subways. They painted all the graffiti out. And they said, okay, New York, we're going to pursue. And more importantly, you know who we're going to catch? We're going to catch people who jump up the subway stills and don't pay the 25-cent subway tokens, right? So, we're going to catch those guys. So, they set up mobile police stations all over the subway station. So, the moment somebody jumped over, they caught the guy, put him there, took photograph, went into the mobile police station, handcuffed the guy, and they started doing that. They did not catch murderers, right? I mean, most of us say let's focus on the big crime and forget about small crime. Right? They went after this, right? And they started to change the culture, and they started finding people jaywalk. I mean, they did all kinds of stuff, but really they started to zoom in on changing the experience that the New Yorker had, because the experience was, wow, it looks clean. The experience was, must be, the belief started to change. And when the belief started to change, the action started to change. And guess what? Murder started to go down, because people started to say, wow, if they catch people who jump 25, who don't pay 25 cents, imagine what they're going to do to a murderer, right?
Right.
And so on and so forth, right? So suddenly you started to see a cultural transformation in New York City that resulted in results changing. So the combination of these three, I mean, we don't talk about business model right now, but essentially the leadership commitment, systems and structures, and culture play a huge role in terms of the infrastructure. You get this right, you're halfway there to getting a person to become world-class,
right?
Because you're giving them all the right sort of aspects to enable them to work. And this happens with athletes all the time. You look at Jamaica, why they have so many middle distance runners, sprinters, or Ethiopia, why they have so many middle. It's not because the facilities are great. There's much better facilities in the US, in the UK, and so on. And Russians, you know, they have, you know, so many Russian tennis players, women tennis players are from Russia, but they don't have that many tennis courts in Russia, you know, or South Korea with golf. So it's strange that, but infrastructurally, like, they have the leadership, they put in structures, and they have a culture to enable this to happen. And that's the first part, right?
That's the first part.
And then the second part is this.
Next part is individual motivation.
Yes. And so individual motivation is, so the first part is infrastructure. Second part is really about the individual. Now, the thing about an individual, most of us will say, if I ask everybody, who likes to learn? Everybody say, I love to learn. Right? But the reality is we don't, because learning is change. And most of us don't like change. Most of us struggle with change. Most of us would rather die than change, you know. And we've seen that many, many times where surveys, you know, you ask smokers to quit smoking and you know, even though you say you're going to die, right? I mean, doctor will say in 6 months' time, you die if you don't quit smoking. Less than 50% would say they'd quit smoking, even though the doctor gives them you'll die. And this is part of the issue with change. Learning is actually change. And so when you give them the infrastructure to learn, the infrastructure to grow, the second part is the individual must want to learn. They must want to go through pain. They must want to be willing to go through the pain of learning, the pain of growing. And there are individuals who say, no, I'm quite comfortable. I don't want to. So even though you have the infrastructure, you may not have you may not have the individual who wants to go through that pain of learning. And so what is important is sometimes you have the individual who wants to learn, who wants to grow, but then you don't have the infrastructure. And so that individual is unable to fulfill the potential. So it's a combination of having these two. And to be very honest, it's actually harder to find, it's actually harder at the individual level, because there, you know, in any case, you'd see out of 100 people, only about 10 to 20% of that 100 will say, yeah, sign me up, you know, and who will sustain themselves. So 20 say, sign me up. But at the end of the day, 10 will really go through that process. Because for you to be a leader, you have to gain experiences, you have to keep changing, you have to keep growing, you have to keep learning. And those are not easy things to do. And we like to do learning, because the best form of learning is not the learning where you sit in, like, you know, we have all these conferences, like, you know, we have one going on right now in Mandarin, right, where people sit down and they listen, right? There's very little learning that happens when you sit down and listen. So most learning that happens in the world today, where somebody sits there and talks to you, right, it's not really learning, it's listening. So you're listening, and you remember about 10% after 3 months. And what happens is you can check out anytime, because I feel bored, okay, I'm on my phone, I can do my own list in my mind, and I can do all kinds of stuff. But real learning actually is by not just by seeing and by listening. It's really by doing.
Yep.
You only learn when you do. When you're forced to do something. When you're on a project. When you're doing action learning. When you do experiential learning, or you're in a simulation where you're forced to do stuff. And the best form of learning is teaching. And this is hard, you see, because not many people will listen and then will practice. Will really practice and then will teach, because when you do that, you know, consistently, then you really, really learn, then you really grow. And that's why we say the best leaders are best. The best leaders are teachers. They're constantly teaching. Because they are learning more. They're solidifying their learning through teaching. So the individual motivation is not something easy. But at the same time, if you can get the infrastructure right, mm-hmm. which some organizations do it really well, you get the right people who have the right motivation, the combination of that too will enable you to be world-class. That's why we have very few world-class not just athletes, but world-class leaders are out here in our country. You know.
Right, so parting words.
Well, I think it's not impossible. Many people say it's impossible. But, you know, I go back to my experience when I came back to Malaysia to run this entity, and we became best in the world, across the world, you know, in terms of what we were doing in that space. And it was not because of better employees or more talented people. It's not about talent, because to me, talent is nothing. I mean, talent is meaningless. It's really about how can you take anybody and enable them to keep learning, but also give them the right infrastructure, but more importantly, enable them to have the motivations, the individual aspiration to say, I want to grow. I think anybody in the country who says, I want to be best in the world, and no doubt they may be curtailed by infrastructure, they creatively, they will be able to find a way to become best in the world, to really push themselves. But if as a company, you know, if you say, look, I really want best leaders, you know, figure out the infrastructure and find individuals that are of that, who have passion to learn, passion to grow, and determination to go through the pain of learning. And the combination of that will enable you to have world-class leaders. You know, so all the best.
All right. Thanks very much. Roshan Thiran, CEO of Leaderonomics. This has been Raise Your Game. I'm Maya Tan, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.